From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
A never Trump, Republican senator says, nevermore. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Yesterday on the Senate floor, Arizona Republican Jeff Flake called President Trump's behavior reckless, outrageous, and undignified.
I rise today to say enough.
Apparently it's not about issues. Flake has voted the president's line, but he told his colleagues Trump is undermining our democratic norms and ideals. So Flake won't run for a second term next year. Will other Republicans just say no, like Bob Corker of Tennessee? Or has the GOP become Trump's party? Later on today's Talking Point, President Xi Jinping is now a historical powerhouse. What will President Trump need to know when he heads for China? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. Two Republican senators, Corker of Tennessee and now Flake of Arizona, say they won't run for re-election next year. It's all about what they call President Trump's outrageous and dangerous behavior. Is the president losing his party, or are the dissidents conceding he's running the show? On today's Talking Point, the Communist Party Congress has just made President Xi Jinping China's most powerful leader in a generation. What will President Trump need to know when he goes there next week? I'll talk with Max Baucus, who's the former U.S. senator who became Barack Obama's ambassador to China. First, this news update. Late last night, Vice President Mike Pence broke a tie vote in the Senate, which sent a measure to President Trump eliminating a rule by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to allow consumers to sue banks. Democrat Elizabeth Warren was outraged.
We spent more than a year listening to you, first as a candidate, then as a president, and you've gone on and on and on about how strong you are, how tough you are, and about how you are going to stand up to Wall Street. Well, this bill is a giant wet kiss to Wall Street.
That addressed, of course, to Vice President Mike Pence. Jessica Silver Greenberg covered the vote for The New York Times. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Tell us about this rule, how long it took to put into effect, and how important it is to Elizabeth Warren.
Well, the rule is important more broadly than Elizabeth Warren.
I think, of course,
she's channeling so much of the rage, the populist rage around this. So the rule took 5 years from start to finish from the CFPB, and it was a really, really big deal, one that I don't think can be kind of overstated. What it did was it reversed this legal maneuvering that had started basically about 10, 15 years ago by some of the biggest corporations in America, American Express, all the big banks. They led this coalition of companies that figured out how to take the fine print of all these credit card contracts and banking, checking agreements and savings agreements and use that fine print to write themselves out of the court system. So that basically they put in these clauses that said, if you get a credit card, you know, or a checking account, you agree to go not to court if there's a dispute, but to private mandatory arbitration, a system that in our investigation of arbitration has shown is really stacked against the consumer, against the little guy. So it was a very big deal because it was really the first and only check on arbitration that there has been from a federal regulator.
Were there Republicans who voted in favor of that measure and against the bill to repeal it?
There were. There were actually two kind of critical breaks with the party, Senator Kennedy and Lindsey Graham, the Republican of South Carolina. And interestingly, with Senator Graham, he had sponsored legislation that would have protected military members from being forced into arbitration. So that's clearly how strongly he had felt about it, and how harmful he thought arbitration was. So he did not go along with the Republican Party vote. And that's why they had to bring in, he and Kennedy, that's why they had to bring in Mike Pence.
John McCain of Arizona was seen as a likely no vote, you have written, but that didn't pan out. Why not? What did he say?
It didn't pan out. I couldn't tell you necessarily the details of why that didn't pan out. I mean, I think one of the things that was really interesting is that, and we got into this a little bit in the story, but Republicans were having a really hard time pulling the vote together, in part because there's been these huge corporate scandals, these two big blow-ups, one at Wells Fargo, you know, which has, admitted to its employees opening credit cards accounts in people's names without their permission, and then most recently with Equifax, the credit monitoring service, right, that had this huge breach of data. And in both those examples, which were then followed up by congressional hearings, there were arbitration clauses. The companies tried to use arbitration clauses. So I think, like, it became very hard for congressional Republicans, in light of those Senate hearings, to then make the case that, you know, arbitration was something that they should preserve, and killing this rule was important. Also, this is a party that, you know, as President Trump has cast it, has run, you know, as Senator Warren has said, against the prevailing, you know, forces on Wall Street and, you know, in Washington, draining the swamp, as they've said. So, you know, this, I think, is a tough rule to kill and be still consistent with that ideology.
All right. The Treasury Department, of course, said that the financial firms could pay $500 million just in legal fees, not to mention the damages they might have to pay as well. And you're suggesting this solidifies the idea that the Republicans are the party of Wall Street. That's certainly what Elizabeth Warren is going to say.
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to say they're not the party of Wall Street when you see that this is a bill. This was a rule that really would have, I mean, I think a lot of judges on both sides of the aisle think that this would have really protected consumers. So, yeah, I think it's tough to make another point.
All right. We'll see if the president signs it. To Jessica Silver Greenberg with The New York Times, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, a never-Trump Republican senator says, nevermore, on To the Point from PRI.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. First-term Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake is a staunch conservative, and he's voted the party line as defined by President Trump. But yesterday, Flake stunned his colleagues by announcing on the Senate floor that he won't run for a second term because of the president's behavior.
We must stop pretending that the degradation of our politics and the conduct of some in our executive branch are normal. They are not normal. Reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior has become excused and countenanced as telling it like it is, when it is actually just reckless, outrageous, and undignified.
Some in the executive branch. McKay Coppins profiled Senator Flake for The Atlantic last month, and Flake called on his cell phone after yesterday's surprise announcement. McKay Coppins, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What did the senator want to tell you?
Well, you know, it's funny because, as you mentioned, I've been talking to Senator Flake basically from the start of the Trump presidency. He was one of the few never Trump Republicans in Congress who never kind of caved. He never offered his endorsement to Trump. He continued to criticize him during the election. And so I was kind of interested in seeing at the beginning of this year, I met him just a couple weeks after Trump's inauguration, seeing how he planned to navigate this kind of brave new world. And what's interesting is, you know, I followed him to Arizona, where he'd had a raucous town hall and his constituents booed and berated him. I was in his office with him and his wife the day after he was at that horrible shooting at the Alexandria park where the Republicans were practicing baseball. And I saw his, over the last kind of 6-7 months, his alarm grow, both about Donald Trump and Donald Trump's character, but also about the state of our national politics and kind of the deterioration of our political culture. And when he called me last night, you know, I will say he sounded tired. He said, look, I don't know if there's a place for someone like me right now in the Republican Party, and I don't see a path to victory, and I'm not willing to do what's necessary, what it would take to win a Republican primary in this climate.
What about the fact that, as you indicated, he got boos and catcalls and was berated by constituents just very recently, just within the last few weeks, and it appeared that he was not going to be a winner even of the Republican primary, or at least it would be a very, very hard battle. What do you say to people, or what does he say to people, who say he's flaking?
Well, I asked him about that, right? Because he gave this very dramatic and, I think, powerful speech on the Senate floor. But a lot of people, especially conservatives who share his aversion to Donald Trump, said, you know, if you want to stand on principle, you should fight. You should go, even if you think you're going to lose, go into the primary and take the case to the voters and let them decide. I asked him about that. And he said, you know, he admitted that there was a temptation to that idea. He said, the pugnacious, competitive part of me wants to go down swinging. But what he also said is that he had to, you know, if he decided to do that, if he decided to take his case to a kind of foredoomed primary bid and ultimately end up losing, which all polls suggest would have happened, he would have had to spend all of his remaining time in the Senate, you know, dialing for dollars, trying to raise money, trying to, you know, basically outside of Washington. And what he said is, I want to spend the last year in office liberated, the kind of liberation that only comes with being a lame duck, frankly. And he plans to continue to speak out against Trump and be completely unbridled when it comes to, you know, being able to vote his conscience and act on conscience and principle.
Let me talk to one of those Republicans who I believe is also a never-Trump Republican, but remains a Republican. Vin Weber is with us. He's a former Republican congressman. He was from Minnesota. He's now a consultant and GOP strategist. He's been a major voice in the party. And I guess you could say, Vin Weber, part of the establishment. Is that right? Are you okay with that term?
I guess that's right. I never actually signed on to the never-Trump movement. And But I was not a Trump supporter in the last election. That's surely the case. And, I guess I'm part of the establishment.
So how do you feel about Senator Flake?
I know Senator Flake well. I like him very much. I think that he's going to be missed just because of his basic decency and integrity. He did make the right political decision. There's just no question he was not going to be able to get reelected in Arizona. And I think, as McKay just said, he wants to be able to do something with the last year he's in office, as opposed to running a fruitless campaign for re-election. But he has some strong views that run counter to the way that the party is moving right now, in terms of immigration, international relations, things like that. And it doesn't surprise me that he feels quite alienated from the Republican Party right now.
But McKay Coppins, didn't he vote pretty much the way that the Republican Party wanted him to vote, and not just the majority leader, but the president?
Yeah, I've asked him about this. This is a common criticism you hear, especially coming from Democrats on the left, who say, you know, he's all talk and no action. His voting record shows that he still votes with Trump 91% of the time. His argument, and I think there's some validity to it, is that, you know, the things that he objects most to when it comes to Trump are things like his proposed Muslim ban, which is not something that was subject to Senate approval. The way he has approached relations with North Korea in a very reckless way, in his view, that's also not something that is subject to Senate approval. The idea that he voted with Trump, I think, is a little misleading because he, you know, Flake would say, I was a conservative Republican long before Donald Trump ever decided he was a conservative Republican, and I still support conservative legislation.
Let's hear a little bit from yet another Republican who has also indicated that he's not going to run for re-election. That's Bob Corker of Tennessee. He chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Here's what he said, or a bit of what he said yesterday to CNN.
I think at the end of the day, when his term is over, I think the debasing of our nation, the constant non-truth telling, the name-calling, the things like, I think the debasement of our nation will be what he'll be remembered most for, and that's regretful.
Ben Domenech is with us. He is a publisher of TheFederalist.com. That's a conservative online magazine, and thank you for being on our program.
Great to be with you, as always, Warren.
So here you are, a Republican on the conservative side. What do you say to what we just heard from Bob Corker, that when this president's term is over, it's the debasement of the nation he'll be remembered for?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a distinction here from what we're talking about with Jeff Flake. Jeff, as McKay was saying earlier, was someone who was consistently anti-Trump and was very critical of him throughout the primary and everything else that we saw there. Bob Corker, at the same time, was actually someone who a year ago at this time was defending Trump and saying that his views were actually good, that he preferred him to some of the other candidates within the primary. He was someone who actually was viewed as kind of a foreign policy surrogate for Trump at various points and potentially considered for Secretary of State, other roles. His Corker's turn is affected by the same thing, though, that I think you're seeing in Flake's decision, which is that in his home state, you had a major donor come out and say that they were going to support a competitive candidate within a primary who was far more pro-Trump than Corker was as a senator, and was willing to throw millions of dollars behind it. In Flake's situation in Arizona, similarly, you saw increased anger among the donor base, where you see that for the first time in a long while, the donor base of the Republican Party lining up with this populist conservatism in agreement that the Senate has not delivered on their promise, and they blame them effectively for not living up to the legislative achievements that they had hoped to see under Donald Trump. That's the real shift that's happened that is driving both of these decisions.
Senator Corker has been talking a lot to CNN in the hallways, and here's something he said about the very issue you're raising just today.
I'm sure that, you know, there's been some Republican erosion over the course of the last, 6 weeks or so with me. I understand that. But when I made the decision not to run, I was in a dominant position. I had more money in the bank than any Republican incumbent. My numbers in the state were very, very strong. And so that's just not true. But look, I don't really care what comes out of the White House. So
Ben Domenech, back to you. It was the White House that, of course, said, as you indicated, that he didn't have a chance to win. How do you respond to what we just heard from him?
Sure. I think that Corker actually would have won re-election, but it would have been a tough re-election. It would have been one that would have really demanded a lot of him. And I think that it ultimately would have been very expensive, just as Flakes would have, though I think Flakes would have had the opposite result, and he might not have even made it out of the primary. The fact is that Flakes' resignation actually sets up a situation here, his retirement sets up a situation here, where Republicans might actually have a better shot of holding that seat, potentially with a recruit that is more open to satisfying both wings of kind of the Republican Party right now. But the real shift, again, that I think we've seen happen is that donors who have been giving to Republican candidates for years are dissatisfied with the health care votes that they've seen that have gone nowhere through the Senate, dissatisfied that they haven't seen a tax reform bill moved forward. And many of them are more openly than ever voicing their discontent. The drop-off in donations to the NRSC in July after the failure of the Senate to move forward on that health care package has been astounding, to the point that Tom Tillis, the head of it, has raised concerns within his own colleagues that they are not going to have the money there to support incumbents, potentially against a slew of populist challengers who line up more with what the Republican base wants, which frankly is more of the Trump agenda.
Okay, we'll be talking further about what's going on in Arizona as we go forward. But first, let me go back to Vin Weber, our former Republican congressman from Minnesota, consultant, GOP strategist, establishment Republican Party member. Is this now Donald Trump's party. Is that what we're seeing? That the people who are, if you will, more moderate or more centrist, whatever the appropriate term is, simply falling out of power.
Well, I think, at least for the moment, and maybe for quite a while, it is Donald Trump's party. The grassroots base of the Republican Party is unequivocally behind Trump and very enthusiastically so, and they're ready to support him against their other elected officials, which is what we're seeing in some of the cases we're talking about today. In addition to that, in almost a literal sense, he owns the Republican Party. I think Ben was just talking about the fact that fundraising for the senatorial campaign committee has fallen way off. Fundraising for the congressional, the House side campaign committee, is not doing as well as it should either. But the Republican National Committee is raising a ton of money, all of it on Donald Trump's name. So he's got the grassroots base with him. He's got his hands on the financing of the party. And maybe at some point, as Senator Flake said, this will pass, but not for a while.
How did this happen? Because when Trump was running in primaries, as I remember, most of them he won by pluralities, not majorities. He didn't do all that well, and of course we know very well he didn't win the total, the majority of the votes in November either. But more importantly, what about the primaries? There were all those other people, and they fell away one by one, largely because cable networks that were carrying the debates just knocked off one candidate after another.
Well, I think that a lot of the reason the grassroots Republicans have rallied so strongly around President Trump is because of his election was such a surprise. You know, everybody likes a surprise present, if you will, and Republicans thought they were going to lose the last election. Most Republicans did, and they woke up the morning after the election and found out that that Donald Trump had led them to a victory, and they controlled the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and they were grateful to him and remain grateful to him. And I think the failure to enact the agenda that Republicans were so giddy about in the days that right after the election is hurting very badly the Republicans in Congress, as we can see. But it's not hurting President Trump. He remains enormously popular as the guy that prevented Hillary Clinton from becoming president, the guy that led our party to victory. And they don't want the grassroots Republicans don't want the congressional Republicans to let him down.
Let me go back to McKay Coppins with The Atlantic. His latest piece is entitled Jeff Flake's Gamble. That's out now at The Atlantic website. Are you looking for other morally outraged Republicans to profile? What about Mitt Romney, for example?
Mitt Romney is an interesting case. We've been hearing buzz about him potentially entering a race for the Senate in Utah. By basically all accounts, it would be a cakewalk for him. He'd win easily here.
Very quickly, he, of course, was governor of Massachusetts, but why would he be so popular in Utah?
Well, he was the first Mormon to capture a major party presidential nomination. Utah is overwhelmingly Mormon. He's beloved. I think I saw a favorability rating in Utah that was close to 80%. So if he decide, he has a house here. If he decide, I'm here in Salt Lake City actually right now. If he decided to run, he would probably win, almost certainly win. And the question would be, what kind of voice would he be in Washington? I think that by most accounts, people say he would be a pretty strong voice in opposition to Donald Trump in at least some cases. So yeah, I don't think that we're necessarily seeing a complete exodus of quote-unquote principled conservatives who are opposed to Donald Trump.
10 seconds left. Jeff Flake consulted with his 5 children about what to do. What did they tell him?
Yeah, he told me that they all told him that they didn't want to see him run a campaign that he wouldn't be proud of, that he wouldn't be comfortable with, and so they were unanimous in their support of his decision.
Okay, Coppins with The Atlantic, thanks a lot for being with us. We'll continue our conversation with our current guests and others. We'll also talk with Ed Montini of the Arizona Republic. Later on, we'll talk about the president's trip to China and what he will face there. Back in a moment with To the Point.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We're not only back with To The Point, talking today about the first-term Republican senator from Arizona, Jeff Flake, who told his colleagues on the Senate floor yesterday that he's not going to run for re-election because he just can't deal with President Trump. He doesn't want to be caught up in what he refers to as outrageous and undignified behavior. So what does President Trump say? Here's what he said this morning.
The first time I saw him on television, I said, I assume he's a Democrat. Is he a Democrat? They said he's a Republican. I said, that's impossible. So look, his poll numbers are terrible. He's done terribly for the great people of Arizona, a state that likes Donald Trump very much, as you, even you will admit. And he would have never won. In fact, even in the primary.
E.J. Ed Montini is a political columnist at the Arizona Republic. And it's great to have you on our program. Thanks for being so patient.
Oh, it's no problem.
So here's the president saying he looked like a Democrat. His voting record is very conservative, isn't it?
Yeah. Jeff Flake is a very staunch conservative candidate. That's really the only kind of candidate that's going to get elected to a U.S. Senate seat in Arizona at the time he was running, for sure. And he's maintained that record all the way throughout his career. It's why, you know, even though he's been a critic of Trump, he has voted for those conservative notions that Trump has pushed legislatively. So that's ridiculous.
And yet we heard earlier in the program that he probably wouldn't win another primary in Arizona. Why not?
I think it's just because the base is the political base in Arizona has always been even more conservative than the candidates. And right now, they are very much in favor of Trump. They like him very much. And so if you have criticized him for any reason, you're dead to them. And they have been very vocal about that.
So there's no question then that Flake did, as Vin Weber said earlier in the program, make the right political decision rather than hanging in there to fight it out during a campaign. What's he likely to do while he's still in the Senate? He's got more than a year left.
Well, I would imagine it'll be a pretty much the same situation as now. And, you know, I tend to disagree with that notion that he made the right political decision. I think that if he was standing true to the principles he was espousing, he would have stayed and fought. Because, you know, honestly, he could have done the exact same thing he's going to do now. I would imagine he will vote conservatively and he will speak out whenever he feels that the president has crossed the line. There's nothing that would have stopped him from doing that as a candidate. And he could have, at the same time, encouraged other Republicans who feel the same way, who have the same values that he has, but who don't believe in the coarse, destructive kind of dialogue that Trump pushes, to come forward and run for office as well. I mean, as it is, you know, he said, okay, fellas, I think this is terrible. I think this is awful. You guys go and fight him because I'm going to leave town at a certain point.
So today in your columnist in the Arizona Republican, you called him a chicken for backing out. What kind of response did you get from the readers?
Good and bad. I mean, but that's the response I get every day.
I would hope so.
I'm kind of accustomed to that. But I think the fact of the matter is that there are people who think, oh, no, he was standing up for his principles and he couldn't lower himself to fight that fight. And I'm thinking, well, if that's going to be the opinion of everybody then you're just going to concede your party to the most base elements, to the the woman who was running against Flake right now. I'm sure there'll be others in time, but the one woman running against him now, Kelly Ward, is a complete Trump sycophant, and if that's what, when Flake walks away, I mean, he's essentially conceding the race to somebody like that without even a fight. And the only other people that are going to enter that race, I would imagine, are going to be some version of her. And I don't think, as nice as the words he spoke yesterday were, they don't mean much without a commitment to back him up.
All right. One of those who is supporting Kelly Ward is Steve Bannon. We all know who Steve Bannon is. And here he is talking before Jeff Flake got out of the race about what he has in mind.
It's an open revolt, and it should be. These people hold you in total contempt. When they attack a Donald Trump and a Dr. Kelly Ward, it's not Donald Trump and Kelly Ward they're trying to shut up. It's you they're trying to shut up. They think that you're a group of morons.
Ben Weber, back to you. You said you didn't sign up as a Never Trump Republican, but you didn't vote for him. What do you say in response to what we just heard from Steve Bannon, who's making quite a case around the country?
Well, I don't understand exactly what Mr. Bannon's real agenda is. I mean, if I understand people are disappointed that we have not repealed and replaced Obamacare and we haven't passed tax reform, but there's only a few senators that you can blame on the Obamacare thing. John McCain is one of them, but he's not up for re-election. The rest of these folks all were very much in line, with the agenda, and we may well pass tax reform before the end of the year. So I think there's something else in Mr. Bannon's agenda, and if you read what he's written over the years, it has more to do with opposition to globalization, international institutions, trade, immigration, things like that. That's what I think he really is trying to stir up with challenges to some of the senators around the country. It's a very dangerous game, though. As Senator McConnell pointed out, we probably got a half a dozen Senate seats around the country that should be in the Republican column right now, but we're not because over the last many cycles we nominated unelectable candidates. If he does damage to our ability to reelect a Republican, to elect a Republican in Arizona and damages some other candidates around the country, we could lose control of the Senate. Huge implications to losing control of the Senate, starting with one of the main issues that helped Donald Trump keep the Republican base together. What happens with the next Supreme Court vacancy? The Senate would have to ratify. So, I think Mr. Bannon knows what he's doing. He's a smart guy, but it's a very dangerous game for the Republican Party.
Back to Ben Domenech, the publisher of TheFederalist.com. What do you say to that? And do you think that Mr. Bannon is moving in the right direction, or do you also agree that he's playing a very dangerous game?
Well, I think there are two things going on here. Number one, I think that the aim that Bannon has is actually pretty clear, which is he wants Mitch McConnell out of that job as the majority leader of the Senate. He wants someone else in that job, and he wants to essentially elect candidates who will try to do that. That's a different view than some of the donors who are also going to be going in a direction that could support other potential Republican candidates. But the truth is, we remember our Brecht, you can't dissolve the people and elect another. Republicans have to deal with the constituency that they have, not the one that they would like to have. And I think that you can actually see in Jeff Flake the tension that is there. He gave an outgoing interview to Chuck Todd from Meet the Press the other day on NBC, where he said how uncomfortable he was when they were talking about issues like flag burning or Terri Schiavo back in the day, and compared it to this moment when they're talking about the NFL and other things instead of limited government and free trade. But it turns out, I think, that one of the lessons we learned from 2016 that Donald Trump understood very well is that embracing those culture war fights are actually the thing that the base really wants to see. They don't really want to hear Jeff Flake's argument for why free trade is so great. They want to hear this argument that is more nationalist, that is more populist, that says that you should respect the American flag, et cetera. And that lines up more with where this populist base of the Republican Party really is. The question is whether that can live with an agenda that has been traditionally more about economic freedom and limited government.
How does all of this coincide, Ben Domenech, with what we heard yesterday, that after Senator Corker had really unloaded on the president in the morning and before Flake's announcement that he wasn't going to run, the president met with the Republicans in the Senate, and they all came out saying, we had a fantastic meeting. It was great. Everybody was happy. We all agreed on the issues. There didn't seem to be any concern at all. And, of course, the president and Senator McConnell threw their arms around one another just a week or so ago. So is this really going to lead to major change in the Senate?
You know, I talked to two of Senator Corker and Flake's colleagues the other day on background, and the expression that they both used was frustration for both of them, because they actually thought this week was one of maybe going to be the first week that they saw some actual movement on tax reform where they could push some stuff forward. They're all kind of looking at each other right now saying, you know, does Corker really want to blow up this tax reform in a package in a way that could do damage to other Republicans who are still trying to be there 2 and 4 years from now? And that's the sort of question that I think will lead to pressure within the conference on both Flake and Corker that basically says to them, hey, look, you know, we know you have your objections to Trump. That's fine. You can go on the air and you can say these things. But we want to pass some legislation because we want to get reelected. And that's something that matters to a lot of them in this cycle, particularly given the opportunities Republicans thought they had to advance the margin and within the Senate.
Let me go back to our columnist at the Arizona Republic, Ed Montini. You're obviously not in favor of the most conservative kind of Republicanism. What about Arizona? You said the base is even to the right of the candidates there, but is there any chance that there could be, as a result of all of this, particularly given that the candidate of Mr. Bannon, Kelly Ward, is regarded as a pretty flaky, if I can use that term, that there might be a strong Democrat who could come across? Isn't Arizona getting to be more and more of a swing state, or am I just absolutely off base?
Yeah, the representative Kirsten Sinema was running for Senator Flake's seat to begin with, and if anything, I mean, if Flake's out of the race and somebody like Kelly Ward is nominated for that job, I would imagine Kirsten Sinema has a pretty good chance, because Arizona, the Republican base is what it is. It's very much a supportive of Donald Trump. But Arizona also has a really large contingent of independent voters, and they do shift around a bit. And, and Sinema can make a strong appeal to them. But we'll have to see who comes out of that Republican race yet. I mean, there are people that are Arizona Treasurer Jeff DeWitt worked for the Trump campaign heavily during the campaign, and he might enter the race. Any one of the Arizona congressmen, Republican congressmen, Trent Franks or Schweikert or McSally or Gosar, one of them might think about getting into the race. Even old Sheriff Joe Arpaio talks about he won't do it, but he'll say something like, "I'm thinking about it." But I think that, yes, there's an opportunity here in Arizona for Democrats, depending on who comes out of the race for Republicans, because Kyrsten Sinema is a middle-of-the-road candidate. He's certainly not a Democratic bomb thrower. You really can't be and get elected in Arizona, even in a fairly comfortable district. Well, that's not true. In a couple of districts, you can. But she's always worked the middle ground, and she has a pretty good reputation, I think. And she's pretty good in public. She's a good campaigner. It would be a very interesting race, and she would have a chance.
Joe Arpaio, of course, can run again because he's not a felon. He was pardoned by President Trump, even though he was convicted.
But the sheriff has, like, all during his career, he's talked about running for Senate, for governor, for this, for that, and he's never done any of that stuff. I mean, I think he knows he probably wouldn't have much of a shot in a race like that, but he loves the attention, so he'll probably bring it up.
What about Senator McCain? He is, and we sort of hate to talk this way, but politics is what it is. He is in somewhat failing health. It's conceivable that he might not be able to finish his term or might decide not to finish his term. What happens then?
Well, that would be a very interesting thing. I have no idea what would happen then. It is the natural situation of politics where I think you always have, the other politicians are like the wolves looking for the weak one in the herd to go down and then pouncing on it. And I think that those same people that I mentioned before would be interested in Senator McCain's seat as well. And you would just have to see how that would particularly go. I mean, even to the extent of Senator Flake, I mean, there are people who believe that his decision here is sort of like playing the long game, that he figures he didn't want to go out losing in a primary, but the fact that he leaves on his own accord means he could get back into the race, say, in 2020 if he wanted to run for president or something like that. I think a lot of these people play this game as if it's a chess match. And with McCain, there was going to be a waiting game no matter what, and that'll just continue now. Although I think there are some people who will jump into the Flake race for sure.
Vin Weber, again, establishment Republican, a former Republican congressman from Minnesota, consultant to GOP strategist. How much do you think the Republican Party is changing? Is it now going to be difficult for people such as yourself or with views comparable to yours to win leadership in the GOP?
Well, it's changing in some significant ways, and in other ways it's not. I mean, look at the big issue in front of us right now. Big issue for the president, the big issue for the Congress, is tax reduction. That's not a change for the Republican Party. That's what Ronald Reagan's big issue was. So some things about the Republican Party are remaining the same. But again, on these international issues, on issues like trade, protection, immigration, things like that, the party has changed very dramatically. And they embraced Donald Trump in the primaries over those issues. And so it's a marked change in the position of the Republican Party. I'm one who thinks ultimately that's the wrong way for the Republican Party to go, but you can't argue that it hurt Trump in the polls last year. He did quite well.
Ben Domenech, again, with the Federalist.com. You're more conservative, I think, than Vin Weber. Do you think good things are happening in the Republican Party?
I think honest things are happening in the Republican Party. I think for a long time, people thought that what voters really wanted was someone kind of like Jeff Flake, or perhaps even more, a little more moderate than him, to someone talking about economic freedom and who had was in favor of free trade and, you know, had sort of a traditional Reagan fusionist view of the future. I think what we're learning is that actually that was out of step with a significant portion of the Republican base, that they wanted something very different, and that these two different factions are really going to have to live together. Those who still have the kind of Reagan-esque economic principles as it looks to the globe, and then others who have other priorities, culture war priorities, or other nationalist views that are being espoused by Trump. We're going to see a real changing of the guard in the Senate in particular, as a number of these senators over the next two cycles leave, not just because of ideological differences, but because of age. And it's a real question whether the people who replace them look more like Jeff Flake or more like, say, Roy Moore in Alabama.
All right. Jeff Flake leaving the Senate along with Bob Corker, not until the end of next year. We'll see what happens in the meantime and who shapes up as their replacements and what it means for the party. Ben Domenech, again, publisher of TheFederalist.com. Thanks to you. Thanks to Ed Montini, political columnist for the Arizona Republic. Vin Weber, a former Republican congressman from Minnesota, and our earlier guest, McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic. President Trump's visit to China and President Xi. In a moment on To the Point from PRI.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We're on here with today's talking point. Mao Zedong was the founder of communist China. He almost destroyed the country with one-man rule. After that, there was government by consensus of leaders until Deng Xiaoping became first among many. This week, President Xi Jinping, the current president, was elevated to similar status with his name in the Constitution, like Mao's and Deng Xiaoping's. Here's part of his address to the Party Congress in the voice of a translator.
We must continue to rid ourselves of any virus that erodes the party's fabric, make great efforts to foster a healthy political environment of integrity, and generate waves of positive energy throughout our party.
Max Baucus was a Democratic senator from Montana for a long time before he was named Barack Obama's ambassador to China. For Mr. Ambassador, welcome to our program, To the Point.
You bet. Thank you.
What do you take from this current change in China and from what we just heard? What does it mean when the leader, apparently without anybody looking even to succeed him, much less to challenge him, say what he just did about the party's fabric and the healthy political environment?
I think it's very significant. It shows that China's rise is now rising even faster and more solidly, and that we, the United States, must take note of that and develop a long-term strategy, just as China has a long-term strategy. But we must develop ours to know how we deal with this. And obviously, it has to be done in a way where we work the two countries better together than opposed to each other. But this is very significant.
You say long-term strategy. That's something the Chinese are famous for. It's not something the United States is famous for, particularly when we have, as we do now, a president that's changing things in to such a great degree. How would you advise President Trump about how to deal with the new situation in China?
Well, I think it's very important that when he visits Asia in a couple of weeks, that he's he stops the tweets, he stops any public criticism of anybody in the region. He's going to Tokyo, to Seoul, and Beijing. And during those stops, especially in China, he has to show to President Xi Jinping that the United States is very firm, very solid, resolute in our efforts to help our interests, and that he must also show to President Xi that he, Trump, and the United States cannot be bullied, just as he, Trump, should realize when he meets with President Xi that China is not going to be bullied. We are both two very proud countries, and it's but we have to work together. It's the rising power and the established power, and it's a real huge opportunity for Trump when he meets with not only Xi, but the new leadership in China, to show that, hey, the United States is solid. It's a country to be reckoned with, and we can't push China around. And that's very important. He shows that strength.
The president and President Xi met once before at Mar-a-Lago when the president of China was here in this country. How successful was that meeting?
I don't think it was all that successful, frankly, at least not in terms of the relationship U.S.-China. I frankly think is maybe more successful for China, for President Xi. They're very clever, the Chinese leadership. When they meet with Americans and others, they tend to play us with a lot of warm messages, warm words, how wonderful things are and how we have to really work together and work through our differences. But they don't really do much more than that. It's an opaque country. It's hard for us as Americans to understand what's really going on in China. But at the Mar-a-Lago, I tend to think it was pretty superficial and not that solid.
President Trump obviously is a man who likes flattery. He's going to get it, I take it, from the Chinese. What should he do? Should he give it back?
Well, flattery doesn't hurt both ways. But one has to remember, you know, the more one flatters, the more one must be suspect and look for your wallet, make sure it's not still there. I think that she will try to flatter Trump, just as Macron did over in France and the Saudis did when Trump visited Saudi Arabia. Trump loves to be flattered. And it's really important for him to realize that to cut through the flattery and stand up and be a responsible president. I know that's, for some, a big question to ask, but in my judgment, that's what has to be done.
You yourself were a longtime politician when you were named ambassador to China, but you were not an expert on China, and you hadn't spent a lot of time there. How long did it take you to learn what you did about how to cope with the Chinese, and how much of a challenge do you think the president now has?
Well, it takes about a year and a half. At about that time, year and a half, I realized, at least I formulated, it's kind of corny, it's what I call my three P's. With the Chinese, you got to be patient, you got to be positive, and you got to be persistent. You got to be upbeat and positive, not criticize the Chinese, but keep working at it very persistently. And after a while, you make a little bit of headway. That, I think, is what needs to be done.
What do you think that President Xi will want from President Trump? You say the Chinese play the United States. How will they play him?
I think they'll be a lot of nice words and say we're working together, the two countries. We're cooperating. And we're two big powers. And just a lot of nice words. He's not going to want controversy. The Chinese at these meetings definitely do not like controversy. They don't like arguments. They like stability. They like to keep things even keel, status quo. So I think Trump will not, she will not be asking much of the United States, except to convey the impression and hope the United States can, quote, work with China and not rock the boat.
President Trump has said again and again that in order to deal with North Korea, we need to rely more on China, and he's made that very clear. Is that a good idea? Is that a good message to take to China, that we need you, China, to help us make sure that the North Koreans don't start a nuclear war?
Well, it's a bit shopworn. It's our message, and was the message when I was the ambassador over there. We raised that message constantly with China, and it got nowhere at all, really. Now, it is true that China's joined the United States to the UN Security Council and joined in with resolutions that have sanctioned North Korea. It helped a bit. But frankly, in my judgment, our administration, President Trump, with the best people he's got around him, should think through how we work with China in a much deeper way so that we're a little bit more partners, not just separate countries, two ships passing the night, but partners and finding a solution to the Kim Jong-un problem. Because look at, she doesn't like Kim building the bomb. We don't like it. We have common cause here. But China's not going to alone be the one responsible for pulling down Kim, because China doesn't want instability on the peninsula. China's worried that if the peninsula becomes unstable, that then South Korea and the United States have much more influence. That's the last thing China wants. So we have to find a common solution with China, which China realizes not threatening to China, that China can work with, and maybe then we can find a way to get some control over Kim. But it's got to be a 1-2 that includes Japan and South Korea.
We just have a couple of seconds left, but you said at Mar-a-Lago that President Xi came out better than President Trump, and you said patience and positiveness and persistence are what are needed for the president to deal with China. Those aren't characteristics that President Trump has shown.
No, but it reminds me of something else. I think the Chinese respect strength and understand strength and can smell strength better than any other people, and they also disrespect weakness and can smell weakness better than any other country. China depends upon strength, and they respect us when they see we are strong. And we have to do whatever it takes to show that, in the best sense of the term, we're strong.
Max Baucus, ambassador to China, 2016 to 2017, Democratic senator from Montana, 1978 to 2014. So good to have you on our program. Many thanks.
Thank you. You bet.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.